ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, Andrew Forrest's attempt to prosecute Facebook owner Meta over scam ads fails in Australia, but he's not finished yet. Also, we look at the effect O.J. Simpson's extraordinary trial had on American society. And the famous bus from The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, has finally been found. Now the work begins to return her to her former glory.
First I was afraid, I was petrified, kept thinking...
They just said, Priscilla, they've been looking for it for years, and they call it the Holy Grail. And I said, well, is it my place?
Criminal charges against Facebook owner Meta have been dropped by prosecutors in Western Australia today. The case was initiated by the mining magnate Andrew Twiggy Forrest, who alleged Meta had published scam cryptocurrency ads using his name and image and then failed to remove them. But Commonwealth prosecutors have decided not to pursue the case in WA's district court. Dr. Forrest isn't finished with the matter, though. His civil case against the social media giant is underway in the US. John Daly has more.
A legal battle between two Goliaths, one of Australia's richest people, Andrew Forrest, and Meta, the company behind Facebook. The mining magnate tried to bring charges against the US social media giant relating to scam advertisements using deepfakes of him to con Australian investors. In a pre-recorded video statement released to the media today, Dr. Forrest was scathing of the platform.
I would really like to talk to you about the refusal of one of our biggest, most important companies, Meta, where they just blatantly refuse to have any influence on the content on their sites, no matter how fraudulent they know those materials to be on its platforms.
But his attempts to bring criminal charges against Meta here in Australia have reached the end of the road today. A WA District Court judge granted Commonwealth Public Prosecutor's request to discontinue three criminal charges under Australian money laundering laws. An alleged victim of the scam, who attended court today, says the result is disappointing, but she vows to continue fighting. She claims she lost $670,000 to a scam, which promised to invest her money in global cryptocurrency markets.
It is a tragedy, and my husband's going to be 70 soon, and we have to still work to be able to go see ourselves through retirement, you know. And at this age, losing $600,000 is coming out of our retirement funds.
Andrew Forrest said in a statement the decision in WA's district court was a tragedy and showed Facebook was beyond laws of Australia. In a statement to PM, a Meta spokesperson said the company doesn't want scams on its platform and it would continue to work tirelessly to prevent them. The Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions gave few details on why it decided to discontinue the case. Melbourne Law School professor Christine Parker says the money laundering charges were a challenging argument.
So the case theory, I believe, was that Meta was recklessly taking the proceeds of crime because they were taking money from the scam criminal actors for the advertising. Yeah, so that seems like a hard case to argue.
The case has raised questions of the adequacy of laws and regulation in Australia. Alice Dawkins is Executive Director of Research Tech Australia, a technology accountability and policy organisation. It's also important to note she's a former employee of Andrew Forrest's Mindaroo Foundation. Alice Dawkins says the discontinuance of Andrew Forrest's Australian legal action against Meta is concerning.
Certainly the themes that this case is throwing up is one of sovereignty and one of ability. So when there are harms suffered by Australians, by an American platform or an American company, what are the avenues for redress? We're seeing that just from a simple capacity perspective, an individual litigant needs to have the resources of Dr. Forrest's volume to even be able to contemplate something like this. And now we've seen today that you can have all the money in the world, more or less, but you will still be stopped.
But it's not the end for Andrew Forrest's fight against Meta. His efforts are now focusing on his civil case against the company in Californian courts. The civil case will determine if Meta is liable for allegedly publishing and not removing thousands of fraudulent ads featuring Dr. Forrest's image. It's challenging a 1996 US law known as Section 230, which gives internet platforms impunity for the content posted by third parties. Alice Dawkins says it will test whether a US company can be liable for Australian operations in the US legal system.
It would be quite a distressing outcome if we sort of meet two ends of the road. What we're seeing here is Facebook is privatising its profits to shareholders and socialising the losses in its local markets, such as the Australian market, with vitally no avenue for everyday people like you or I to seek a remedy.
Alice Dawkins from Research Tech Australia, that report from John Daly. To federal politics now, and it's been a week in which international conflict has fuelled political arguments at home. The foreign minister's flagging that Australia may recognise Palestinian statehood in the hope it could speed up a peace process drew fierce criticism from the opposition leader Peter Dutton. He accused Senator Wong of doing irreparable damage to Australia's relationship with Israel and the Prime Minister of failing to tackle anti-Semitism. But Peter Dutton's comparing the government's response to a pro-Palestinian protest to the Howard government's response to the 1996 Port Arthur massacre has drawn a particularly strong response from other politicians. Our political reporter Nicole Hegarty is in Parliament House in Canberra. Nicole, Peter Dutton's reference to Port Arthur hasn't gone down well in Tasmania in particular. How have MPs there responded?
Well, that's right, Sam. And we've heard from Bridget Archer, who's known as a somewhat outspoken federal Liberal backbencher for Tasmania, who's labelled her leader's comments as incredibly disrespectful and saying it was somewhat bizarre of a comparison. We've also heard today from the Premier in Tasmania, Jeremy Rockliff, also a Liberal. He says the incident remains very raw and has cautioned against any comparisons to it. He says he's confident, though, that Mr. Dutton will reflect on his comments.
This is a tragedy that will forever be in the hearts and minds of the Tasmanian people. It is very raw. I don't like making any comparisons with the tragedy of Port Arthur. It's inappropriate.
Other Tasmanian Liberal senators and MPs have also backed in Mr. Dutton's comments, saying that he was right to point to a lack of leadership. But they've notably not used the words Port Arthur in their responses at all, so steered clear from that aspect of the comments made on Wednesday night.
Is Peter Dutton continuing to defend those comments?
He is. He took to his regular segment on the Today Show on Channel 9 this morning, backing in those comments, saying that his point was a legitimate one, particularly saying that he was labelling a lack of leadership on the part of the Prime Minister in relation to that protest on the steps of the Opera House last year. Here's what he had to say this morning.
The point I was making, which is absolutely a legitimate one, is that I thought this was a time for the Prime Minister to show leadership and to step up. Instead, we've had crickets, and you've got a contrast, I think, with John Howard, who stood up.
And, Nicole, there's a by-election in the Sydney seat of Cook tomorrow to find Scott Morrison's replacement. Labor isn't fielding a candidate, and it's all but certain the Liberal Party will retain the seat. In terms of voter support for the Liberals, what would be a good result for Peter Dutton?
Well, Peter Dutton will be looking for a continuation of the status quo. We know that the seat has been held by the Liberals for half a century, and two-party preferred vote-wise, Cook has become even safer for the Liberals in recent years. There was a swing against Scott Morrison in the 2022 election, but Liberals were still miles ahead of the Labor Party, and Labor is not contesting this by-election, so they're feeling fairly comfortable, and Peter Dutton Dutton is confident heading into this, but he'll be looking ahead at what the result might mean for the next general election next year, because there's we heard in the last federal election lots of references to the Teals or Voices of movement, so community candidates supported by groups in the community, and there's one of those which has been founded in Cook as well, and there's some suggestions that support for an independent community-backed candidate might be growing in that seat as well. So that's something to look at, but the impact of that's mostly being seen as come next year when we're looking at the federal election rather than this time round.
Our political reporter Nicole Hegarty in Canberra. Overseas now, and world leaders are increasingly worried the security situation in the Middle East is about to worsen, with Iran vowing to take revenge on Israel after an airstrike earlier this month. Several senior commanders were killed by the strike on the Iranian embassy in Syria. Israel has put its military on alert, and the United States, Russia and Australia are all urging Iran to show restraint and warning that retaliation could plunge the entire region into chaos. This report from Rima Chia.
Fears are growing that the conflict between Israel and Hamas could spread into other parts of the Middle East. An Israeli airstrike on an Iranian consulate in Syria 2 weeks ago that killed seven people, including a senior Iranian commander, has raised tensions. And while Israel hasn't claimed responsibility for the attack, Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei says Israel must be punished. That's a major concern for the United States. Karine Jean-Pierre is the White House press secretary.
Obviously, we don't want this conflict to spread. We've been very clear about that. We communicated to Iran that the U.S. had no involvement in the strike that happened in Damascus, and we warned Iran not to use this attack as a pretext to escalate further in the region or attack U.S. facilities or personnel.
The U.S. is mobilizing leaders from across the region and the world to put pressure on Iran to back down on its threat of retaliation. Israel says it's preparing for all scenarios following warnings from the U.S. that Iran could launch a significant attack. Its military spokesperson is Daniel Hagari.
An attack from Iran's territory will be solid proof of Iran's intention to escalate in the Middle East and stop hiding behind its proxies. In recent months, we have improved and advanced our offence capabilities, and we know how to act where needed. We have a multi-layered defence capability that has proven itself during the war with thousands of successful interceptions.
Shahram Akbarzadeh is a professor of Middle East studies at Deakin University. He says the attack on Iran's embassy in Damascus carries the same significance as an attack on Iranian soil.
It's really difficult to imagine how they will respond, but they are put in a position where they have no option but to respond, because if they don't, they're going to look weak and powerless among their friends in the axis of resistance. There are talks of Iranian response in the Golan Heights. So working with the Syrian army, take some action in Golan Heights. I don't know if that's a realistic option for Iran, and I don't think Syria wants to be involved in that kind of conflict, because it will bring Syria into open confrontation with Israel again. But it's going to be devastating for the whole region.
He believes the embassy attack is Israel's attempt to drag the US further into the conflict in the Middle East.
In the past, Iran has refrained from direct confrontation with Israel simply because Iran knows that the costs are so high that Iran cannot cope and manage the high-tech Israeli armed forces and, of course, the U.S. involvement. So Iran has relied on its proxies, but now Iran is really has its back pushed into a corner. Iran would look at a diplomatic response by galvanizing the international community, the United Nations, to issue a condemnation of Israeli attack against the Iranian consulate. But the UN Security Council has not discussed it, has not issued a condemnation, which has really left Iran very little choice. And that will promise to bring the United States into open confrontation.
The White House says it expects an attack by Iran against Israel, but one that would not be big enough to draw Washington into war. Shahram Akbarzadeh says Iran would welcome a chance to avoid direct confrontation.
I think they would quietly welcome an international intervention to pacify them, to somehow promise some kind of international sanctions, response, or condemnation of Israeli action. It's important for Iran to be able to save face in this situation, because it is, in a way, the victim of an assault.
Shahram Akbarzadeh from Deakin University. That report from Rima Chir. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, Australia Post ending daily letter deliveries from next week. Well, it was the televised murder trial that gripped America and the world for a year. In 1995, football star and Hollywood actor O.J. Simpson was acquitted of the stabbing murders of his ex-wife Nicole Brown and her friend Ron Goldman. But he was later found responsible for their deaths in a civil case. The infamous Simpson has died from cancer at the age of 76. Rachel Hayter prepared this report on the influence his life and alleged crimes had on American society.
Simpson, would you please stand and face the jury?
The accused man had reasonable doubts etched into his face.
We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant Orenthal James Simpson not guilty of the crime of murder.
The infamous O.J. Simpson murder trial was televised live, and in the United States, people's response to the verdict was influenced by race.
Black people reacted very different to this entire situation than white people did, based on their experience, particularly with police officers. It was a period that we went through that was really picking the scab off the wounds of America.
US television presenter Rolonda Watts covered what became known as the trial of the century.
African Americans throughout America said, finally, finally, there's going to be justice, particularly against the police, by a black man being defended by an incredibly brilliant lawyer who also happens to be a black man.
An American football hero and Hollywood actor, O.J. Simpson, was charged in 1994 with killing his ex-wife, Nicole Brown, and her friend, Ron Goldman. Both found dead, repeatedly stabbed, their throats slit outside Nicole's L.A. home.
Remember, America was just coming 2 years off the Rodney King tragedy, where we, for the first time, saw on video this man being brutally beaten by the police officers. It was there on film. 2 years later, we've got O.J. Simpson, and I think, you know, I really think the reaction to his death, the trial and everything, was based on your experience as an American citizen.
When O.J. found out police were on their way to arrest him, he fled, leaving a letter reading, "I've had a great life, great friends. Please think of the real O.J. and not this lost person."
Now they have picked up the white Bronco on the 5 freeway.
The 100-kilometre chase across L.A. freeways broadcast live to engrossed spectators.
Now police radio saying that Simpson has a gun at his head.
3 decades later, this man lives in the L.A. neighbourhood of Brentwood, where Nicole and Ron's bodies were found.
I don't have any hatred to him, but I think he murdered his wife and he got away with it. And then the police got even with him in that thing in Las Vegas. I would say, as a citizen, no particular loss. Sorry to see anybody die, but I'm sure some people out there are missing his wife as well.
The attorney who represented Nicole Brown's family, Gloria Allred, is not mourning O.J. Simpson either.
He went on to do the ultimate act of violence, which is killing her, leaving her almost decapitated right on the doorstep of her condominium. Those two young children, Sydney and Justin, could have walked out any moment looking for mommy and found her.
Legal analyst and author Charles Rosenberg watched the trial for E! Entertainment.
If you looked at him, he didn't look like a killer. He was very well dressed, handsome, and he had that aura about him of some people who are famous carry with them.
An observation parodied by the American rock band Good Charlotte. Johnny Cochran, Simpson's charismatic defense attorney, also became a household name for his legal performance.
It makes no sense. It doesn't fit. If it doesn't fit,
You must acquit.
CNN reporter Stephanie Elam gave this analysis with Jake Tapper today. Social media describing the report as saying the quiet bit out loud.
And it's also just worth noting how much was impacted by this trial, Jake. So many things happened. We saw policing changing here in the city. And it's also worth noting, because of that unrest, that racial unrest in the 90s, that is why so many people who may not have been invested in O.J. Simpson were just happy to see that someone who was rich and famous and black could get away with what other people did in the system as well, too.
A separate civil trial jury in 1997 found OJ liable for the deaths and ordered him to pay $33.5 million to the families. But OJ Simpson would not avoid jail forever, later serving 9 years for 12 counts of armed robbery and kidnapping two sports memorabilia dealers at gunpoint at a Las Vegas hotel. This Grammy-nominated song, The Story of OJ, by American rapper Jay-Z, implying that Simpson's wealth and celebrity meant he was given special treatment by the American justice system that other black men don't get.
I'm not black, I'm OJ. Okay.
Financial freedom, my only hope, the verse goes. I'm not black, I'm OJ.
Rachel Hayter reporting. Daily letter deliveries are about to become a thing of the past, with Australia Post changing its schedules from next week because of a dramatic shift in demand for its services. While we'll have to wait longer for letters, the Postal Service says its parcel delivery and collection options are expanding, and it's hoping the changes will ensure Australia Post stays viable for decades to come. Here's Gavin Coote.
In the digital age, using the postal service to keep in touch is more of a novelty than a necessity for many Australians. Harita, who's doing her PhD in finance, is among a dwindling number of people who still rely on post.
I think it's a very interesting way to keep in touch with people. It's more personal, I feel like, rather than just sending a text message.
What about as a researcher? I imagine you use emails as part of your hourly business, but do you rely on the post as well for you at your work?
I have never done that. I'm not sure. I think if you need a response, you should actually send an email. Nobody's going to respond to a letter mail, I guess.
Letter volumes have been in long-term decline. They've dropped about two-thirds since their peak in 2008. With its financial viability in question, Australia Post is now overhauling its delivery schedule. From Monday, letters will be delivered every second business day, and delivery times for an ordinary letter will be extended by one business day. Grandparents Tony and Ginny, who live on the north coast of New South Wales, are disappointed but not overly surprised.
Ludicrous.
Particularly where you are up in northern New South Wales, you've got grandchildren and children all across the country, so snail mail must be still pretty important.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's a way to keep in contact, because you can't. And the kids like getting a card or a letter or something
rather than...
They like
the money in the card.
Yeah, they like that too. But, you know, they actually like that connection.
Australian households receive on average about two letters per week. And Australia Post says it expects this to halve within 5 years. At the same time, demand for parcels is booming, a shift that was amplified during the COVID pandemic. Paul Alexander is an adjunct associate professor of supply chain management at Curtin University.
From about 2016 thereabouts, Australia Post knew that it had to do some major changes. It's pretty clear when your main product that you are there to sell is delivery of letters, when the market for actual letters is declining rapidly. And at the same time, something else you sell, that is parcels, is increasing rapidly in demand. So having those turnarounds is really pretty stark for any business to suddenly be seeing how that's changing.
A daily priority letter service will remain available for customers who need fast delivery of mail, but it will come at a higher cost. Australia Post says the changes will allow it to focus on expanding parcel posting and collection places, something the Posties Union supports. Shane Murphy, the national president of the Communication Workers Union, is pleased with a recent trial of the new model in some locations.
This has, in essence, increased productivity by around 20%. It's improved the flow of parcels to customers. Feedback from those trials were overwhelmingly a success, both from the posties who did the job and from the community who are receiving a better parcel service and expectation around that. This just sets up the model for the future. The expectations and the way people have used Australia Post over the last number of years has significantly changed. And the new model of delivery is reflecting that change. And when you take the posties with you, they're a part of the process of, you know, doing the job every day and looking at a new model on the way forward, and you come out pretty successful at the end game.
With its future now certain to be in parcels rather than letters, supply chains expert Paul Alexander thinks Australia Post has been relatively quick to adapt.
Funny enough, for a big organisation like that, they are pretty agile. They can be agile. If the government and everybody, all the various players, even the unions, hadn't have accepted that this is the way they had to go, they would have been behind the eight ball and they would have been in a bad position. But these changes are only just where we are now. There's, if you look down the road in the future, there's still going to be more technology changes, and the organisation itself is going to have to alter quite a bit still to do that.
How guaranteed is the future of Australia Post as a government entity, do you think?
Well, it now has to become profitable, because that's its main bargaining chip has always been, is that it produces a net positive revenue and does Australia make, you know, a huge service.
Requirements for Australia Post to maintain a minimum presence nationally and in rural, regional and remote areas will remain unchanged.
Gavin Coote. Finally this evening, to the discovery of a missing piece of Australian cinema history, the bus that took three drag queens to the outback in the classic film The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, disappeared nearly 30 years ago. But Priscilla has now been found on a New South Wales farm, and it's hoped she can be restored to her former glory. This report from Angus Randall.
It's one of the most iconic images in Australian cinema. Guy Pearce standing in a giant silver shoe on top of a bus in the middle of the outback. For 16 years, the bus from The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert has been sitting in a paddock in Ewingar in the New South Wales Northern Rivers.
I said, why is everyone asking me about this bus? He said, oh, that's Priscilla. I said, oh, straight, mate, fair dinkum.
The bus went missing soon after filming. Around 2006, it was abandoned on the New South Wales property, which was sold 10 years later to Michael Mann. He wasn't the first to claim he'd found Priscilla, so when he contacted the SA History Trust in 2019, it took some convincing.
And then talking to people in the bus industry, they just said, Priscilla, that's the hunt for Red October. They've been looking for it for years, and they call it the Holy Grail. And I said, well, it's at my place. And everyone just didn't believe me. I had a copy of the contract for the movie, I had all the rego papers, the complete history of it.
It was almost destroyed by fire during Black Summer, but Priscilla would survive.
The flames were 50 feet above treetop, 360 degrees around me. The fire actually went straight over the roof of my house. The fire burnt right alongside Priscilla, went under the front bull bar, took out two cars in front of it and a car and a boat beside it. Yeah, it wasn't meant to go. It had a purpose.
The bus will eventually go on display at the National Motor Museum in the Adelaide Hills after a serious makeover. In the movie, the bus cost $10,000.
I hereby christen this budget Barbie camper Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
But the SA History Trust says it needs at least $750,000 to bring Priscilla back to a roadworthy condition. Daryl Carthew restores cars at the Classic Factory, just down the road from the National Motor Museum. He understands why it's so expensive.
It's just hours, just the amount of labour required. It's just crazy. I mean, I've never done a bus like that, but I can only imagine the amount of time. It'll be very rusty. It's just all time consuming. You can't buy any of those panels, so you're going to be making all of that stuff from scratch, making all the joins in factory places, using the same welding techniques, the same materials, just trying to keep it as original as it was.
Acme in Melbourne is home to perhaps the only Australian car that could rival Priscilla for fame, a replica of the Mad Max Interceptor. Jeannie Maxwell is a curator at Acme and says turning a prop into a permanent exhibition can be difficult.
So many film props are not, unlike artworks, designed to be displayed. They're usually not designed to be kept at all. And so preservation efforts can be like quite complex in ensuring that they can be on any kind of display.
They say putting the bus on display will help celebrate the role Priscilla played in opening up Australia to the world.
Priscilla, Queen of the Desert was a film that brought an Australian sense of humour to a global audience. And also Australia's incredible and long history with drag culture. So it's a testament to a much longer history of Australian queerness, as well as having been a huge international success in its own right.
The restoration of Priscilla is expected to take around 18 months.
Angus Randall. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is David Sparks. Technical production by Joel Kassam, Lena Elsardi and Nick Drakoulis. I'm Samantha Donovan. Have a great weekend. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. For decades, music festivals have been a big deal, attracting millions of revelers. But the appeal seems to be dying away, with a string of cancellations this year. Today, Double J's national music correspondent, Zan Rowe, on whether the big music festival can be saved. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.